Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello, and welcome to What is Going Om's Truth in Medicine show, co-hosted by me, Sandy Sedgbeer.
And by me, Dr. Donice Warden. And this month, we'll hear some breaking news about exciting new approaches to cancer.
And with us tonight is cancer research hero and venerated breast cancer surgeon, Dr. Robert Elliott, whose research over five decades has resulted in a number of breakthroughs, including a patented vaccine for breast and prostate cancer and other advances.
And Sandy, I've just returned from Dr. Elliott's Research Center and Medical Center, and I cannot tell you how excited I am for our listeners tonight and what they're going to get to listen to. There's so much, but we're going to try to introduce them to Dr. Elliott and all that he has going on. He has over 100 published papers. He's a member of many professional organizations. And I will tell you, when I knew that we had to have him on the show, I saw him lecturing at a major cancer research symposium, and he took a call from a patient on the stage when he was lecturing. And I knew then, this is not just a researcher, this is a physician on the ground with his patients, and his patients came first. With that, let's welcome Dr. Elliott.
Yes, Dr. Elliott, thank you for joining us. Now, you've dedicated your entire career to fighting cancer. In your book, Breast Cancer, Anger at the Enemy, you share how you came to wage a war against this enemy, not by design, but by divine intervention, when you could no longer ignore an inner voice that kept leading you in this direction. Tell us a little bit about that journey. What made you so angry that you decided to commit yourself to breast cancer research?
Well, it started with a lady named Irene Whiteley in Anniston, Alabama, where I was practicing in general and thoracic surgery at that time. And she came in one day after having, in those days we were rather crude in how we treated breast cancer. Women signed a permit breast biopsy, and if it was cancer, they woke up sometimes with out of breath without any preparation and counseling and things like that. And she brought it to my attention how crude we were practicing that art. After about a year that she was out from a radical mastectomy, she came to my office. She asked me did I know anything about a program called Reach to Recovery, which is a program that was sponsored by the American Cancer Society, where mastectomy volunteers counseled with other mastectomy patients right after they got out of the hospital. And I told her no, I wasn't familiar, and she said she would like to start that program in Anniston, but they had to have a clinical advisor. And would I be the clinical advisor? And once I did say yes, reluctantly, but she got me involved in this volunteer thing, and I realized how I am emotional and really devastating it was for a lady to have breast cancer. And the more interest I got, the more patients I got that were breast. And make a long story short, I knew I had to start an early detection center, and as a surgeon, wasn't anybody doing mammography. In fact, in those days, it was early art. And I just decided that I would dedicate my practice to diseases and cancer of the breast.
And I'm so glad that you did, Dr. Elliott. That's good. Will you tell us a little bit more about the clinic and the Cenobrite and the early detection and how you're doing things differently nowadays in your clinic?
I will do that, but let me start just a little bit about how we opened the first center. In those days, they were using infrared imaging. And a lot of people thought it was really hocus-pocus stuff, but the French had done good work, and if you do, that's called thermography, And so our clinic opened up with thermography and dedicated low-dose film screen mammography that was pioneered and developed by a great radiologist up in Philadelphia named Izzard, Dr. Izzard. I went to his center and learned how to do mammography and read them, and if it hadn't been for him, I think with the radiation scare in the 1970s about mammography, with him not developing that low-dose film technique, mammography might not have survived, but it saved many lives, and he deserved a lot more credit than he got through the years. But I opened up with low-dose film screen mammography and thermography and just good examination. Now we have really dedicated breast ultrasounds, and we have digital mammography, and what you mentioned, the Cenobrite, is a contrast-enhanced digital mammogram where you give a contrast agent to the patient, and the physics on this particular machine then changes, and you can see if the contrast localizes to any small area. And if you get a real good focal enhancement of that area, it's going to almost be an early cancer. So that's helped us a lot in equivocal cases.
So another thing I think, Dr. Elliott, that was different about your clinic is that you were doing these tests while the patient was there. Most times, if there's a suspicion, we send them off to all these different places. They have to wait, and that time frame is excruciating. They're worried and they're concerned. You were doing it in the office that day and giving those patients those results.
You're exactly right, and Dr. Warden. I call it one-stop shopping. And it is the truth that the women that come to our center, we're not just an imaging center. We are actually a comprehensive breast clinical diagnostic center. And that's a lot of difference in the way we practice and the way you do it. When some lady goes to an imaging center and she sees a technician who does a mammogram, a radiologist doesn't see her, and they read it, and then she has to worry about the report for a week or two. And sometimes the report goes to her primary care physician, and they fail to call her and tell about it. I get that story all the time. The patient, when they see us, they know whether they got a problem or not. When they leave the clinic, they know they're either going to see me in a year or 6 months, that they got a problem.
You know, thermography is something that many doctors, even today, don't use. They're still recommending, you know, either 3D scans. That's quite progressive for that time to have been doing thermography back then.
Yeah, well, I'm proud to say, although in the young days, when I came, had a young, pretty wife, and she was a family practitioner, and I was a surgeon going to limit my practice to breast and do that. Everybody said he's going to starve to death, but his wife will keep him eating. But you know, God works in mysterious ways. Right the year I opened up, you remember Happy Rockefeller? No, Nelson Rockefeller's wife. You all are probably too young to remember all those days, but she got breast cancer, and there was a lot of media coverage about that. Then right after that, Betty Ford got breast cancer. A lot of media about that. And believe it or not, I don't even know how they found out about this, but somebody from New Washington, I guess because I'd somehow or another gone to a meeting and I was just practicing breast surgery. I got a call from somebody as a consultant about Betty Ford, and that got somehow in the local media, and the next thing I knew, there was a TV reporter coming to my clinic that wanted to interview me, and I know that was just some kind of spiritual event, because if I hadn't been in practice, I said, it don't make sense. And after that, the doors were knocking down with people coming, and so in a year, I had all the breast surgery in Baton Rouge at that time. It was just, it was a miracle.
You know, five decades is a very long time, you know, to spend in research. And it seems to me that, and I'm just a layperson, that it's only in more recent years that we seem to be seeing a hell of a lot of progress all of a sudden, including, you know, what you're working on, the cancer vaccine. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'm going to yield some of that to Dr. Warden. We talked about that when she was here. There is a great amount of research is going on, and obviously we've made some really great surprise. I mean, I guess we've made a lot of progress in targeted medicine and so-called personalized medicine. But the thing that disturbs me the most after all these years of making progress, it seems like we hadn't really got it across to the public to either get the early detection really good, or we're certainly not making as much progress right now. Well, let me say it this way. We may see some benefit in the next few years with statistics. It takes a while for some of this. But, Donice, you remember we talked that if you have a stage 4 cancer patient, it doesn't matter whether it's breast or what, the results are almost as bad as they were 40 years ago. The death
That's
rate is
correct.
Still about
in fact,
the same.
That's right. In fact, that death rate in some cases is actually more than it was. So we have not been winning the war, and that's why I want our listeners to know about you and your work and your state-of-the-art research facility and what you're doing, because you're a pioneer and we need to be behind you in all ways, because I also know your heart, not just your mind, about this.
Well, I think the way we're going to prove it is the way we proved in our breast cancer adjuvant breast cancer vaccine study. And we talked about that, but we've had the approach in treating cancer that is we're going to just kill the cancer and be all these cytotoxic agents and surgery and radiation, and that's the big three: surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. Well, all of those are very immunosuppressive to the patient. And once you tell the patient they got cancer, their immune system starts going haywire anyway. So I found out in the late 70s, early 80s that it was important to have a healthy host immune system, even if it wasn't specific to the cancer, for patients to do better. Even some guys in Italy reported patients under therapy that maintained a good, normal, absolute lymphocyte count did much better as far as survival. And I had many experiences. I told Dr. Warden about one of them, about a lady that came in after a year and had her first workup, had a very devastating catastrophic family event, and within 2 months after being checked thoroughly, she had metastatic cancer. So I started concentrating on the immune system, and I think what's happened, Dr. Warden, is every patient that's got cancer that gets the standard of care treatment we talk about, after they finish it and they got no evidence of disease, they all should be vaccinated to that target, and that's what we started doing.
So, Dr. Elliott, tell us a bit more about the patented vaccine for breast cancer. I mean, you know, how did you find this?
Well, it was a long kind of journey, but we knew that there was a man that worked for the NIH, his name was McCoy, that I ran across that had learned, he was working really with some other kind of immunology, but he had taken breast cancer tissue from breast cancer patients. And he had developed a test where he could see if the lymphocytes had any kind of antigenic recognition to that tumor. And his first study was, and he didn't know what kind of standard of care treatment they got, but he got their tissue at the NIH, a specimen from their tumor. And he did that particular test. It's called a lymphoblastogenesis assay, or you can call it lymphocyte stimulation by multiple mitogens. But he found out that following those patients over 10, 12 years, that the patients that presented that already had really good host immunity to their own tumor had much better survival. And I was at a meeting in 93 or 91 or something like that, at Washington, on a cancer immunology meeting, which was, believe me, very meager, because there wasn't too much being done. And Rosenberg was still doing his TIL cell stuff with the TILs, and I think you know what that means, Dr. Warden, and yeah. We won't get into that. Yeah. But in making a long story short, I said, if you can make people and you get their tumor and they already got good host immunity and they do better, why can't we take the ones that's on the curve that's not doing better, and instead of doing the test with the autologous tissue, why don't we make a vaccine to that autologous tissue? And we first started out making a homogenate out of the cancer cells. And then as we evolved, we found out that making it, if you have enough tissue with an homogenate and the whole cells, you can kill the whole cells either by radiation or incubating in a very strong antibiotic called mitomycin C, and that makes the cells be cytotoxic. They won't replicate you. They won't grow. And we did all kind of experiments to see what's the best way to inject the tumor and all that kind of stuff. And we started doing that and monitoring that LBA I mentioned, the lymphoblastogenesis assay. And that's basically, and now the vaccine has their cells. It has some homogenate. It also has some allogeneic cell lines that are killed the same way. And it has some special and proprietary, what we call biological adjuvants. And we were the first to publish about having biological adjuvants. And I'll tell you, that's easy. It's GM-CSF small dose, which is a colony-stimulating factor to make the stimulate your migration to the target where you're vaccinating of what we call antigen-presenting cells and dendritic cells. And then we've used a little IL-2, which is something that stimulates the patient's lymphocytes to proliferate after they process the antigenic information and go into clonal expansion. I know that sounds, I hope some of your listeners are enjoying some of that because it's kind of...
I'm going to interpret in a minute.
Yes. We might want to bring that back to a simpler plane, Dr. Warden.
I'm going to have to hold you there, Dr. Elliott. We have to go to break now. You're listening to What Is Going On's Truth in Medicine show, and tonight we're discussing some exciting new breakthroughs in cancer treatment with cancer research hero and venerated breast cancer surgeon, Dr. Robert Elliott. We'll be back with more from Dr. Donice and Dr. Elliott after this break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Hello, this is Dr. Donice Warden, and I'm excited to tell you about homeopathic injections from Hevert Pharmaceuticals. I utilize them in my practice for pain, inflammation, depression, and other medical conditions. I'm achieving excellent results, and I've seen no adverse reactions. I encourage you to explore these novel treatments.
Call Hevert today at 855-387-6466 to find a practitioner in your area to administer these FDA-registered medications. 855-387-6466.
Change and growth are part of natural life and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Dr. Donice Warden, just before the break, I know you were going to tell us a little bit more, expand on what Dr. Elliott said, and tell us about some of the successes that you're seeing.
Yes. Well, I will just let everyone know that Dr. Elliott holds two patents on vaccines. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Elliott, but one is breast cancer and the other one is prostate. But he's also working on other types of vaccines for different types of cancers. In fact, I've been sending some patients to him. It's very exciting. And what I like is that he's working with the body's own immune system. So when he says host immunity, he means you. He means your body and your own immune system and how to work with that immune system to help fight the cancer. So that's an exciting piece of what Dr. Elliott has going on, and I trust him, and I like his research. And another thing, the patients love him. When's the last time you were touched by a doctor? He not only touches his patients and really talks to them, he knows their names, and I actually saw him kiss the forehead of a post-breast cancer patient. So this is the art of medicine that's being lost. But let's get back into the science a little bit. Sandy, I know you wanted to ask about the antibiotics and what he's finding with that.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot lately about antibiotics. I mean, we've heard so much over the years. They were hailed as the most important discovery of the 21st century. And then we were told, you know, we've been overusing them. They're not as good as they seem. So what's your view?
I think that antibiotics are good, but I think we have been too good in overusing them. And we've created resistant organisms. We have also not realized, and that's where the exciting stuff that Dr. Warden and some of the people we've met and we're kind of communicating with, and also just not just host immunity. To have good host immunity, you have to have good nutrition and good metabolism. And I think they work hand in hand. The developing the metabolic approach to treating cancer, which Dr. Warden can talk about in a little bit, if we do that, we can make things better so we can get a better, healthy immune system. It's very complex, but in all honesty, the antibiotics, to go back to that, as James Blaser wrote a book, Missing Microbes, How Antibiotic Overusage is Causing Our Modern Plagues, such as even reflux and stuff. And the microbiome, we as doctors and physicians, and still today, I go to big meetings and they talk about all this immunotherapy, but they don't even discuss the microbiome. And that's the importance of having a good, healthy gut. That's where immunity starts, is in the gut. And I think that it's been neglected. I think we use antibiotics indiscriminately. And my rake has been really working on that the last 8 or 9 years, because I've realized that mitochondria are very important in our health. That's a little organelle in our cell. Everybody calls it the power plant. But in all, truthfully is a evolutionary bacteria. So if it's kin to the bugs we are, we give a lot of antibiotics, we can alter and damage mitochondria in our cells. And mitochondria are associated with dysfunction, that is, with cancer, neurodegeneration, probably autoimmune disease, and everything. So when you take an antibiotic, if you don't do other things to kind of help, which we can go into maybe later, you are damaging some of your healthy mitochondria, which is really, I think it all starts there, don't you, Donise? Is Dr. Borden there?
I wonder whether we have lost her. I can't hear her, so maybe she's got cut off, but I'm sure she'll call back in. So can you expand a little bit more on some of the research? Oh, there she is. Dr. Warden?
Sorry about that. I don't know what happened. Lost you there for a minute. But let me just play off of that microbiome. We've talked about it on our show before, Sandy, but that is a very big piece of research, and it's amazing that Dr. Elliott is tied in this damaging of that mitochondria inside the cell. And I was fortunate enough to be in his laboratory and see under the microscope pictures of that the damage that had been done. The other thing that I'd like to bring to our listeners' attention is that something that everyone said couldn't be done, and Dr. Elliott did, he transplanted the mitochondria into different types of cells. So I think that is something that we need to acknowledge him for as well.
I really do think that if we learned And we're going to learn more how to really get healthy mitochondria by isolating them from normal cells. I think that the mitochondria can be a sort of cellular biotherapy in the near future to help neurodegeneration, ALS, Parkinson's, those diseases, as well as probably help us treat cancer. I truly believe that, and I think it's coming. That's going to be a lot of interest in that. But antibiotics may be contributing to those diseases I just mentioned by the damage it does to our cellular normal mitochondria. But I just published a paper that antibiotics, friend and foe, from wonder drug to disrupting the tumor the microbiome, disrupting mitochondrial function, and causing pro-tumorigenesis. Actually, we may be causing cancer in some people who may have the right mutation by giving them indiscriminately antibiotics.
So is the answer to that to just really monitor and cut back on our use of antibiotics individually?
If the person has a really bad infection, you need to know what the organism is. Be sure you have the sensitivity so you give the right antibiotic. And we've learned in our lab, and we showed some of that to Dr. Warden last week, if you give an antioxidant and you target the antibiotic to the right drug and you really protect the microbiome by giving a really good probiotic, you can cut down on the risk of injuring the mitochondria, and then you can still fight the infection. I'm not against antibiotics. I just think they've been used improperly and overused. And some doctors are lazy. They want to satisfy their patients quick, and they come in and say, I got a cold, or I might have the flu, and they give an antibiotic to them, and that's not going to even help what they got.
Most of those are viruses anyway. That's correct. And you're damaging
right.
Good things in the meantime. 100% in agreement with you. Yeah.
Right.
So let me ask you another thing that I'd like for you to tell our listeners when I was there is about how we're doing research and how those cultures come in into a plate, and it has antibiotics. I want you to describe what you discovered, because this is going to turn a lot of heads in the research world. It's going to create a lot of waves, but you're seeing what you're seeing, and I want our listeners to hear it.
Well, you brought up a subject that is going to already make them want to shoot at me quicker.
I know it's important.
We were kind of stupid ourselves, but make a long story short, what she's saying is we did a lot of this work on mitochondrial dysfunction, and especially the damage that antibiotics do in cell culture. And it was many different cell lines, all types of cells. And we were testing them again, which antibiotic causes more reactive oxygen species, which means stressing the cells real bad, or decreasing the so-called electrical membrane potential. But to make a long story short, after doing all that, it dawned on me that all the cell culture lines you get from the TCC, they come to you incubated in antibiotics. Mainly one that's really strong called gentamicin. And that means that these cells are already incubated, and then you add another antibiotic to it, and it's making a long story short, we started doing it in antibiotic-free media, and it changed all the results. Now, it's harder to do. You got to be really careful with sterile technique. But the cells and all the cell culture in the whole world is done in antibiotic media to keep, and it's the lazy man's way to do it, I guess, because it keeps them from getting contaminated. But all the reports in cell culture media and all the statistics, including mine that I did in previously, is probably not right, because we're working already with a stressed and diseased cell. So now the results that she mentioned are totally different when we do it in an antibiotic-free culture media. In fact, we looked at that today, Donise, and gentamicin, it makes the cells a lot different. And I got some good live cell imaging today that I'll show you later sometime about how much difference the membrane potential is and how much more reactive oxygen species those cells have and how stressed they are. And we did a lot of, PCR DNA studies on them, too. You know that. You saw that.
Yep. Well, you've got the state-of-the-art lab, and you're doing the right kind of studies. And as we progress, it's called the art of medicine, art of research, as we find something that we've been doing incorrectly, we have to acknowledge it, even if you get your head taken off of, which I think you might a little bit, but you're solid in what you're finding. You're solid in what you're finding, and it means that we need to change things. We need to look at it. And researchers that have done previous research, especially in the cancer world, when we're working with these cell lines, we could be wrong. And maybe that's one of the reasons why we're not winning the war on the number of deaths of cancer. Maybe we've been looking at some things incorrectly because our research way of doing it has not been as accurate as it should have been. So this is groundbreaking for all of us.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right because, you know, many a lab is in business today doing so-called chemosensitivity studies where they take the patient's tumor, grow it out, and then test various drugs to see which way they react. But you know what they do when they do that? They are harvesting and trying to replicate those cells in a good cell culture media with an antibiotic. And then, so it can work both ways. We've seen this. If it's incubated in an antibiotic, sometimes you increase the sensitivity of the thing to the, you know what I mean, of the cell to the drug. Yep. And sometimes you make it more resistant. So if you're doing that and it's completely a paradox, you may be saying, this drug is good because the cell's sensitive. But in essence, if it wasn't treated with an antibiotic, it might have been a resistant cell line. And when you're in the, I don't know anybody that's giving antibiotics prophylactically when they give chemotherapy. So you could get, and it may be that you could even sensitize the patient's tumor if you gave some antibiotics.
Which means it might work better. We don't know yet.
You might make it more chemo sensitive. Oh, that's right. But it's right. We got a lot to learn, and I think it's a lot of data out there that we live by that's inaccurate.
Dr. Elliott, tell me what your thoughts are on a ketogenic diet. You mentioned it earlier, and the metabolic theory of cancer.
Well, I've been impressed, and I'm a believer. And I'll be candid and honest. I have people help me with that, and my wife had a stage 4 cancer, and we worked hard at doing it. But I believe in it, and I think that Donise is a little more versed on the ketogenic diet and how to do it the right way with the right supplements than I am. That's why I'm going to beat her brains and pick her brains out a lot. But we have coaches, and we have other people that help us. But to answer your question, there's no doubt in my mind that Warburg was right. Cancer is a metabolic disease, and I think that it starts with defective mitochondria and poor cellular respiration, and anything that happens in the nuclear instability downstream of that and the oncogenes is just downstream from mitochondrial dysfunction. And I think the ketogenic diet stresses the cells more, so it makes them more sensitive to definitive treatment and chemo and everything. But it also, if we can learn how to stop lactate transport in the cell, which I think we can, and working on some of that, you can make the cell almost explode. And then, why don't you tell them, Donise, what D'Agostino's doing in association with ketogenic diet and ketosis and hyperbaric oxygen?
Right. We've had a show on that before, Dr. Elliott, and we're going to have Dr. D'Agostino on very soon, but really what you're saying is all these different therapies that we know that are working synergistically are the ways to go about it. We need the vaccines. We need to work the immune system. We need to work with the diet. We have to work with anything and everything that we know that makes those cancer cells weak and our healthy cells healthier and stronger to combat it. And so that's why when groups of like-minded physicians that are open, that are doing good research, get together, great things can happen. And that's why your foundation is very important, which I want to make sure our listeners know about, because I'll be trying to help you in getting, we're going to do some events, we're going to do all kinds of things, because Dr. Elliott needs to continue his research. Dr. D'Agostino and others that he's talking about sometimes are funded by, funded by the Department of Defense or by universities. Dr. Elliott has help from those areas as well, but for a lot of the part of his research, he's funded himself because he knew he needed to do it right. He couldn't be slowed down by academia or other institutions. And that's why we, as listeners and people who are interested in this subject, need to help support his foundation. And Sandy and I will make sure that we are going to get that information out to everyone and how we can do that, because we appreciate you, Dr. Elliott.
Well, thank you. We appreciate you too. And I learned the people here were excited about you coming, and they were sorry to see you leave. And you really turned on a lot of minds in my little clinic, and you're making a great contribution too. But the truth is, if the metabolic treatment is efficacious, I think it also helps the whole immune system too. And if we can get stage 4 cancer patients where we can control their disease, get a minimal tumor burden, that's the time it's important to really vaccinate them to their own target. And then, it's like I was telling Dr. Warden, you can't just say bye after the vaccine and series you gave them. You've got to monitor that over a period of time as you follow the patient for recurrence. And when they dip in that immune profile that we just mentioned about LBA, that's the time to give them a booster. Just like in the old days when we were kids, we used to get booster typhoid shots and booster tetanus shots and all. You can develop memory in your immune cells, and if you start dipping, and then the cancer immunoediting can get out of balance. Have very minimal micrometastasis, but if something catastrophic happens to your immune system and your immune system is already kind of mellowed out, it's good to keep it up there where the numbers are good and the T cells have good memory and they already recognize that target.
You're listening to What Is Going On's Truth in Medicine show. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. And
I'm Dr. Donice Warden.
And this month we're talking about exciting new breakthroughs in cancer treatment and prevention. We'll be back with more after this break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Hello, this is Dr. Donice Warden, and I'm excited to tell you about homeopathic injections from Hevert Pharmaceuticals. I utilize them in my practice for pain, inflammation, depression, and other medical conditions. I'm achieving excellent results, and I've seen no adverse reactions. I encourage you to explore these novel treatments.
Call Hevert today at 855-387-6466 to find a practitioner in your area to administer these FDA-registered medications. 855-387-6466.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. Om Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single Om Times endeavor. Host your show with Om Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Dr. Elliott, Dr. Warden told me about some of your research around toxicity and iron overload in our bodies. Tell us how this is significant.
Well, iron is, we have to have it. It's very important, of course, in carrying oxygen in our system, but iron is... can be, and if you're overloaded, it can make a lot of stress in the cell too, cause mitochondrial damage, and cause a lot of what we call free radicals. I'm sure some of the listeners have heard about free radicals, and everybody's trying to be healthy and take coenzyme Q10 and all the right antioxidants. But iron is also an essential micronutrient DNA synthesis, and it is through an enzyme called ribonucleotide reductase. And we've learned that all cancers obviously make more DNA because they're proliferating rapidly, and they express transferrin receptors on their surface. That's an transferrin is a protein that carries iron in our body. So that's a thing we did for years on targeting tumors by taking transferrin and getting the physiologic binding sites rather than having iron have metals like platinum and gallium. And you can do a whole lot of non-toxic selective so-called chemotherapy by doing transferrin conjugated, using transferrin as a by conjugating it to cytotoxic agents as a carrier directed to the tumor. And we still do that in some time patients. In 87, I gave a paper in France on that, and Bristol came to me and wanted to start a big project. And I thought, well, we're going to really make it big and be wealthy now. But about that time, AIDS came along, and the way we got our transferrin was pooled serum from the Swiss Army. And people got real afraid of HIV, and that killed that project. And I think it's delayed the progress in that field a great deal. There's another great scientist at UCLA, Manuel Pinochet, and he and I collaborate on all these conjugated drugs by binding stuff to transferrin and targeting it to tumors. But iron, the cancer cell uses so much iron, it can't utilize it all, and it would kill itself off. So it binds it to a non-toxic protein so that iron won't be toxic in its cell called ferritin. And that's why the serum ferritin goes up in bad disease patients. So iron is very, very dangerous to take as a nutrient when you got cancer. You have to balance it very carefully because they do get anemic. But iron is an iron cellular buildup of ferritin is immunosuppressive and makes it also more resistant to drug treatment.
That was important we have information developed for our listeners.
We have developed, and it's very expensive, but we're getting there, an antisense or an oligonucleotide to disrupt ferritin synthesis intracellularly. And if we can keep the cancer cell from developing ferritin so it binds the iron that it can't use, then we could actually give iron in as a therapy to the cancer cells by binding it to transferrin and give it. And the cell would take in all the iron. When it releases it to the cytoplasm in the cell, if there's so much in there that it couldn't rebound and make ferritin to keep it from being toxic, I think this iron would be so bad as a free radical, it would kill the cancer cell that way. And we've done that before a little bit intracellularly with cell culture methods, but guess what, Denise? We did that about 20 years ago.
The gentamicin, yeah.
We did it with cells that were incubated in a antibiotic media. So I'm gonna have to repeat that now.
I know it. But this, I want to bring up something very important here. Is that our listeners really understand that our mind and our emotions are a big ally, powerful for us to be able to help our own immune system. And I think some of the most important work that you're doing on my end as a practitioner out there was teaching us that you know the importance of stress and that doing different treatments at different times of when a patient has been diagnosed. So in other words, there are certain things you do the minute they're diagnosed because that immune system does something different in that moment. Then once you get a diagnosis, it does something different. Then it's time for a treatment. I want you to talk to us about that because being able to meditate and pray and manage those stress during those different times is important. And you're the only one I know of that's broken it down like that, that the treatments should be specific in the timing of a patient's diagnosis through their treatment.
Well, you're exactly right. When you tell a patient sitting across the desk from you that they've just been diagnosed with cancer, that's when everything right then starts. They have stress, they have increased cortisol levels in their blood, catecholamines go up, and those are all immunosuppressive. And then when we treat them with surgery, that is obviously immunosuppressive. But there are ways to help that, and that is to, once they got to need confidence in their doctor, you need to know that they're not treating their cancer, you're treating them. And it helps to give the patient the techniques you mentioned about anxiety reduction. It's okay to give them a mild, I think, antidepressant or something like that. And it helps to reassure them, teach them relaxation techniques, and all of that. And then when you get into the treatment, we know that if you do surgery, and it's been shown in other countries that are really interested in this, and there's not too many interested, unfortunately, but you can give a mild beta blocker and do certain things like that and cut down on the incidence of recurrence while you're in the intraoperative period. And it's all those little bitty things add up. In fact, I wrote a paper, and it was called Psychoneuroimmuno-Oncology, and I think I had some tables in there, and you caught me where I can't remember what I even wrote, but I think there's a lot of I took the immunosuppression that happens to the cancer patient, and I put it in stages. Yeah. One was at the diagnosis, and one was during the workup period and counseling, and then the intraoperative period, and then in the adjuvant setting. So we try to attack patient's anxiety and immune system all the way through those stages.
You also knew that
other things we do now, and I think Dr. Warden can tell you more about that, is we use, now I'm probably not using the right supplements, so I'm going to be afraid to say anything because I'm going to ask her what I got to use from now on. But we try to support the lymphocytes after we tell the patient that, even going through for surgery, by giving them a mushroom product and hopefully, do that. And then I think all cancer cells, especially prostate cancer, is zinc depleted for some reason. And so sometimes we put them on a zinc supplement and things like that. But I'm learning as I go, and I've learned a lot from her and D'Agostino and Tom Siegfried at Boston, who's put cancer as a metabolic disease. I think it's a combination approach. But, the most important thing is looking at the doctor across the table and knowing he cares about you.
Yeah,
I think if people know you care and you are compassionate, they're going to have less anxiety.
That's absolutely invaluable for a patient. Let's talk about prevention and, what we can do instead of taking antibiotics and steroids, and what other things that we can do, to help prevent cancer.
Well, I think that having good mitochondrial health is important. I think avoiding obesity is definitely important. I think eating the right, and she's an expert at that, having better nutrition. Now, I'm the pot calling the kettle black because I hadn't adhered to all those standards through the years. But
it's,
I think
good,
it's all
Southern food down there.
we're what we eat, and I think that's important. Yeah. And one of the things I've learned after being in this mitochondrial research is mitochondrial health is very important for everything. And one thing that makes it really healthy and increases what we call mitochondrial biogenesis, so that the mitochondria can replicate in intracellularly and know how to die the right way and go through mitophagy and everything, is exercise.
That's right.
And I think Dr. Warden was talking about new concepts of exercise this past weekend, where sometimes you can get the same benefit from 2 or 3 or 4 minutes or something of some kind of active stuff rather than trying to run 80 hours on a treadmill or something like that. Isn't that right, Donise? And you say that?
That's correct. The interval training is showing up to be better. 6 minutes of hard and, you do 1 minute hard and fast and 1 minute slow. There's different ways to do it. But when you shake it up and you push hard, but you do it for a little bit of time, it's better than just getting on there and running for hours. That causes more oxidative stress, and that's why sometimes marathon runners have a higher rate of cancer, because they're creating free radical damage from pushing too hard for too long. So everything's about moderation, your diet, your stress, your exercise, all of it. It's about what's the best one for you as an individual. And so we're getting better at the prevention part, I think, but also prevention is making sure you've got a doctor like Dr. Elliott that's going to look at you from all those levels, and be able to see, are there any stressors that he can see coming? And it's not just the typical blood work. He's doing unique kinds of testing to be able to see, hey, that's not looking very good in this area. So maybe you're going to step up your exercise and your diet because you're more at risk. And it's not just your genes either. It's specific tests with your immune system.
Well, you've raised a really good point there, Dr. Warden. And, you know, but we don't all have access to doctors like Dr. Elliot. So, you know, where are the rest of these amazing, courageous doctors like him? How do we find them?
Right.
Well, I worry about medical education. I really do, because unfortunately we're becoming so digital that the new docs don't even look at the patient, much less touch them. They are looking at the computer and talking with their head away from them. I'm worried about that. You know, it's been shown, and I know Dr. Warden knows about this, that you can make certain cortisol levels and all kinds of things that have involved in stress and whatever, you can allay some of that if you just go into the hospital room and hold hands with the patient and touch
them.
And rub their arm and talk about things and ask them, do they need anything? It's been shown brain waves change that way when you do that. All kinds of stuff helps. And it's all a part. And anybody that goes into medicine that don't know, love people and know how to touch them and relate to them, I feel bad for them. But there's a lot of folks out there. I hate to say that, but it's true.
And it's the truth. And I feel bad for the patients, too. And what I tell my patients is when I send them to a specialist, if they don't feel a connection with them, you fire that doctor. They work for you. You're hiring us for our medical expertise. And if you don't connect or you don't feel like you're being listened to or that I know your name, you should fire me. And so I give them the strength to be able to say, you're fired, because And no pun on that. Sorry about that.
You sound like Trump.
Yeah, I know it. I knew that would come up. But really, we should be firing our doctors.
I'll tell you right. Listen, when I do my consults about definitive management and surgery for the cancer we're treating, and they want second opinions, I say you most certainly ought to do that. You got to feel comfortable with their doctor. And you got the right to fire me at any time if I'm not meeting your expectations.
That's right.
But I hadn't been fired many times, I don't think. But I
was going to say, what I saw when I shadowed you in your clinic were patients that had been with you for many years. They had had mastectomies with you, surgery with you. They trusted you. They wanted you. And you felt more like family to them. I saw it. And I felt it. And we've lost that in medicine. I appreciate that in you. So here we have, Sandy, this beautiful physician that connects with his patients in all the ways that we know are highly important for the patient to get better. But he's also a leading edge researcher. Why don't you tell him your schedule? Tell him what time you get up in the morning.
Well, I usually
tell everybody about it.
Well, I usually get up at 3 a.m. most of the time. I usually get to my clinic around 4:30. There's always a lot of paperwork and fax machine lab works coming over. And I've always made a point that I want to communicate with my patients, because when they know they've had a test and a study, they don't want to wait 6 weeks or 10 days to get it. So I press my people that do that kind of stuff to let me have a report quick. Call me if there's something bad. And I tell my patients, now, you're going to get a call early. But I want to do it when I'm fresh and I can communicate with them and before I get busy and beat up all day. So I do a lot of calls, important calls like that, between 6 and 7 in the morning, so they can hear that information and know when we're going to see them and make it a more further explanation about things. Then we usually see patients to 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But I've cut down. I just do that on Monday and Tuesdays now. Wednesdays we do surgery. I'm cutting down on that. But Wednesday afternoon, Thursday, Friday, and through the weekend, I'm in the lab.
Well, you know, I hear that we're getting closer to cloning. So perhaps that's what we need to do with you, Dr. Elliot. We're almost out of time now. I think we've got about 30 seconds or so left. So, Dr. Warden, if you could just quickly tell our listeners, where can they go to get more information?
Exactly. They're going to want to see Dr. Elliot, and it's E-L-L-I-O-T-T, and it's breast cancer. Actually, you have that in front of you, too, Sandy. I've misplaced it here. It's breastcancer.com, I believe.
I think
breastoncology.com, I think.
Breastoncology.com. Yes. Breastoncology.com.
We also have a blog that we're starting and trying to get a little mile out of it called YourBodyYourAnswer.com.
Good. Well, we'll certainly add that one to our list. And I think, Dr. Walden, you're also you're going to be publishing a lot more material on your own social media outlets, correct?
That's right. That's right. So I'll keep him up to speed as much as I can with Dr. Elliott. He's hard to keep up with, but anything new he's got coming out, I'm going to try to put it out there on my systems as well, and I know you will, Sandy, as well. So we'll keep everyone informed because he moves quick, and I'm not going to say how old he is because it doesn't matter. A 20-year-old can't keep up with him. Cannot keep up. And I move fast.
Listen, I'd like to thank you both for the opportunity to talk to y'all tonight.
Well, I would like to thank you for being so caring and compassionate, Dr. Elliott. It's a rarity.
Yeah, it is. It is. And he's going to keep us going on this research world, and we're going to support him all the way through.
Right. Well, it looks as though that's all we have time for on Truth in Medicine today, where our mission is to bring you the very latest information, reports, and research from leading-edge science and new integrative medicine. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer.
And I'm Dr. Warden.
And if you want to learn about the latest, healthiest innovations in medicine, stay tuned. We're here on the last Thursday of every month. That's it. And it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye. Good health intentions from both of us. Thank you.
And thank you, Dr. Elliott, so much for joining us today.